So now what we'd like to do is Arthur Zients and I are going to talk a little bit about how the Montessori philosophy and method and the Waldorf or Steiner method and philosophy embody applied mindfulness. So what we're going to do is I'm going to talk for just a minute or two, well, a little bit more than that, a little bit about the history of Montessori, a little bit about the background, and then Arthur's going to talk a little bit about Waldorf and Steiner. And then we're going to have a sort of a conversation, he and I. It's going to be kind of low-key. Originally, I thought I was going to do some big movement activity, but I'm just too tired. I'm being honest, yes. So Maria Montessori lived... Actually, what's interesting is both Rudolf Steiner and Maria Montessori lived around the same time. She was a little bit younger than him. She was born in 1870, and she died in 1952. She was the first woman in Italy to become a doctor, which was not an easy thing to do back then. And she studied psychiatry early in her career. In fact, she studied with Freud, and Anna Freud was one of her friends. And she started out working with poor and mentally handicapped children in the slums of Rome, and started developing a curriculum that was intended to awaken senses and to embody learning through experience, direct experience. She was interned in India during World War II because she was an Italian subject. And during that time, she became very spiritual and had kind of a transformation. She became involved in theosophy later in life, and her writing became more spiritual. So the Montessori method has gone through various evolutions over that period of her life. She lived a long time, as you can see from the years she was alive. And it's interesting because Rudolf Steiner and Maria Montessori have sort of symmetries that are almost opposite in a way, which you'll see when you hear about Rudolf Steiner. But if you're interested, if you Google D. Coulter, D-E-E-C-O-U-L-T-E-R. She wrote an article called Maria Montessori and Rudolf Steiner, something asymmetries or something, symmetries. It's a really interesting article if you're interested in this. So one of the really important things that came out of Maria Montessori's time in India was this understanding of cosmic education, being able to teach children that all things are interconnected, that they're all part of the universe, and they form a unity. And so this, she called this cosmic education. And it formed, obviously, it was one of the things that she wrote about later in 1948. But this came out of her trying to resolve the issues of the war of the time and thinking about the needs of how do we teach peace? How do we teach peace in the world? The way we teach peace in the world is understanding that we're all connected, that we are one. You know, that is one way to resolve war. And where do we teach this? We teach this to children, because children become the future. So this is a lot of her philosophical, spiritual work came out in response to the war at that time. One of the ideas that Maria Montessori brought to her work, and I think that one of the most important things, the commonalities between the Waldorf philosophy and the Montessori philosophy, are this understanding of the spiritual seed that the child contains, that the child themselves is a spiritual being that is unfolding, and that the unfolding process is to be highly respected and appreciated. And so the whole environment, and including the adult in that environment, is very intentional and is very designed in a particular way in order to create this enhanced environment whereby this spiritual being can unfold and develop. So we must take into consideration that from birth, a child has power in him. We must not just see the child, but God in him. We must respect the laws of creation in him or her. And then this called this the most precious treasure, this spiritual embryo, because it was only this divine formative power that could transform the world. The child promises the redemption of humanity. Again, this understanding that the child is where we can find redemption for the world and developing peace. She also, Marie Montessori had a really uncanny ability to observe. She spent a lot of time observing children, and because she had this medical background and this medical training, she applied it to observing children in a lot of different environments, and she watched children and did a lot of experimentation with different kinds of didactic materials that were designed for teaching certain things. And she noticed that children basically develop who they are, their personality, their sense of self, their everything, from the environment. And she called this the absorbent mind. So basically, you are incarnating, or you're developing a body-mind through your interaction with the environment. And this is through these sensations, impressions, and feelings that you get from the environment. So another part of this philosophy that is really, really important is the teacher preparation. So obviously, if you have a philosophy whereby this child is recognized as this spiritual embryo that needs nurturing and needs this prepared environment in order to fully develop and thrive, then the teacher preparation becomes really important. We must believe that all beings develop by themselves, of themselves, and that we cannot do better than not interrupt that development. So she recognized that this innate desire to develop and grow is something that we must let happen naturally. We must confess ourselves to ourselves that the psychic life of man is full of mysteries. The preparation for the teacher is twofold: to be sensitive to the mystery and to be sensitive to the wonder of life revealing itself. So basically, when you're a Montessori teacher, and just to give you a little background about me, which I should have told you before I started, but my first experience in education was as a Montessori teacher. And I was trained to be a Montessori teacher back in the late 70s, and I started a Montessori school in 1980 and ran it for 22 years. And I taught all different levels of Montessori, from infancy and toddler Montessori all the way through elementary school over the course of those years. And what I found was that it's this creation of this environment, this prepared environment, including the teacher. The teacher is part of that environment. And there's this recognition that the teacher's emotional state and the teacher's actual presence becomes part of the environment, and a really crucial part in the environment, because the teacher is a model and the teacher sets the tone. And so when the teacher is presenting something or introducing something to the child, there's a recognition that of the spirit of the energy of that presentation. So it's not just we're going to sit down and learn this, but it's we're going to work together to use this learning experience as a transformation, basically. So learning becomes a transformative process in and of itself. And you can teach in this, it's teaching in a contemplative way. And what you find, and I like to use Vygotsky as an example of this, because I feel like when you're doing that, you're actually scaffolding the experience, the contemplative experience for the child, and you engage your class in this contemplative experience. And you're not necessarily teaching meditation, but the whole lesson becomes a meditation, whatever it is that you're teaching. So it could be any subject matter. And that, to me, is really exciting, and it makes teaching, it enlivens teaching in a way that's very powerful. So just briefly, to give you a little bit of background on some of the philosophy. The early years, Montessori considered it the period of absorption and sensitivity. And her feeling was that at this age, children needed order because they're trying to make sense of the world. And they like to do things a certain particular way. And so often, Montessori's been misunderstood because at this age, often teachers show children how to do something a particular way. But it's not, we're not necessarily expecting the child to do it that way. If the child has the impulse to do it that way, which they often do, then they can follow that way. What we do is we show them something very specific, and we show them in a very specific, careful way, And what happens is you have a class of 20 children, and you're showing them a very simple activity, but you have their attention. And it's like watching somebody do tea ceremony, if any of you have seen that. It becomes a contemplative experience for the child. And then often, some children will take that activity, and they will do it with that same contemplative, slow, deliberate movement. Not always. Sometimes they spill it all over the floor. And depending on the interpretation of Montessori, you'll have some people who will be more rigid about that, other people will be less rigid about that. So there's been, you know, the application of Montessori varies a lot. And I just have to say I've seen, you know, all kinds of different Montessori schools. But I think the idea is that you're helping children develop their powers of concentration through this slow, deliberate activity. And this is a preschool activity. It's not for elementary school. So there's also this understanding that children at this age like to repeat things until they master them. And they do things for the sake of doing them, not for the outcome. They're not looking for, they're not goal-oriented, they're more process-oriented. And they enjoy making contact with their world. The next level, the 6 to 14-year-olds, they're more interested in being independent. They're developing more of a moral sense. And they're understanding more abstract and imaginative kinds of learning. And then between 12 and 18, there's what Montessori talked about, a physical metamorphosis. Obviously, you're going through adolescence. Your body's completely changing. Back when she was doing schools, kids would go and live in a farm school during adolescence, and they would learn how to take care of farm animals and, you know, manage a farm away from their parents, because she wanted them to learn self-sufficiency and in that kind of environment during this period of life. So this is an example of some of the preschool lessons, which I'm most familiar with. Like I said, there's this presentation with reverence and awe for respect for the materials. One of the things I love about Maria Montessori's the materials in the Montessori environment is they're all really beautiful. And when you put together an activity for preschool kids, you use the best kinds of quality of things you can find. For example, if you're doing a pouring exercise, which is done a lot in Montessori preschool, you use glass pitchers. You don't just give them plastic, you give them glass. And what happens is they become very careful with the glass. They love the glass. It's beautiful. There's a lot of sensory experiences embedded in the curriculum. For example, if you're doing another transferring activity, which is very popular among preschoolers, where you're spooning some beans from one container to another, you'll use a material that sounds beautiful when you transfer the material, so that when you transfer those beans, you hear this, you know, tinkling sound of beans dropping on glass. It's beautiful. So there's an approach that captures the senses, that attracts the attention of the child in a very sensory way. There's a lot of things about the curriculum that I could go into, obviously, but I think the thing that's important is that teaching itself can be contemplative, and that you can introduce children to things in a contemplative way. Another example of this, when I was teaching elementary school and I was teaching about animals, and I would start out teaching about fish because we would go through each of the vertebrae, the vertebrates. And so we would start with fish. And the first thing we do is we take a real fish and in a fish bowl, and we put it in the middle of the group, and we sit in a circle and we watch the fish. Just quietly watch the fish for maybe, I don't know, 2 or 3 minutes, and just watch. And that becomes a contemplative experience of fishness. And so before you start talking about anything about fish, you've had a real sensory experience of what a fish is and what a fish does and what the experience of fishness is. And that itself becomes a contemplative practice before you start talking about gills and breathing underwater and any of that. So I think that's pretty much everything. In the preschool curriculum, these are the areas, you know, the activities of daily living and motor skills, which is the transferring kinds of things. You've probably all seen those frames, those dressing frames with the bow ties and the buckles and things like that. There's sensory training materials that develop the refining the senses. There's nature, art, math, language, history, and geography. That's just my references. So this is that presentation is up on the web for you to reference later. So I'm going to pass this on to Arthur. We will have questions later, so.
Thank you.
So oh, sorry, Arthur,
I'll introduce myself.
Okay.
That's all right.
Thank you.
Otherwise, I'd have to introduce you, but now I get to introduce myself. So I'm Arthur Zients. The name does not look at all like it's pronounced. I mean, it's pronounced in pronunciation and spelling, or we have to be Polish to appreciate the spelling. But you just remember art and science, and then you've got my name. All right. I'm here as a bit of an imposter. That is to say, I'm a quantum physicist from Amherst College. Why am I talking about Waldorf education? But here's the storyline. Okay, Tish and I were talking one evening about our common pasts in education. She is a Montessori school teacher, and I as a founder of the Hartsbrook School, which is a Waldorf school serving our area, in which my wife still teaches, in which I was the board president of for 10 years. And our children went to the school for their elementary school years and had a wonderful experience, and I'm still actively connected to that school and to many other schools. So I have some knowledge, although not from the classroom side of the Waldorf pedagogy. And I've been doing a lot of work in the last 10 years with introducing contemplative practice into university and college classrooms, both at Amherst College and through the Center for Contemplative Mind and Society, where I direct the academic program, which is to say, professors who are interested in this all around the country get together and come to a summer school that we might run, or a retreat, or a conference, or make use of resources we have on the web, or a whole variety of other activities. So after they leave your high schools, they come to my colleges and first-year seminars and this, things like that, where we do include meditation as well. So I have a long-standing interest in personally in meditation, its relationship to pedagogy, both in the Waldorf context for K through 12 context, but more recently, especially at the university level. So that's the short version of why I'm standing in front of you. I'd like to just give a little bit of a history of how this whole thing started, connected to this austere-looking Austrian philosopher, Rudolf Steiner. And if I get anything wrong, there is one good Waldorf teacher, at least in the room, John Miller, who's back there. So John, I may be depending on you to save me at some point. Is there anyone else here who's taught in a Waldorf school? Great. What's your name?
Tom.
Tom, great. Wonderful. So you can also help me out in case I stall out someplace along the line. Clearly, this is just a vignette, just as Tish did. I'm just going to give you, another 15 minutes worth of intro to this. Connected, sometimes these schools are called Steiner schools, as well as Waldorf schools. The Waldorf comes from the first school, was it associated with the so-called Waldorf Astoria cigarette factory. No connection to Waldorf Astoria in New York. The German who started this school in Stuttgart just liked the name. All right, he thought it was kind of cachet, Waldorf Astoria. So, okay, we're the Waldorf school movement. Emil Malt, we have him to thank for that. But in any case, Rudolf Steiner's dates, 1861, 1925, contemporary with Maria Montessori, a little bit older. He started out in the philosophical and scientific background. He became the editor for several years for Goethe's scientific works, published 5 volumes in that, lived in Weimar for a period during that scholarly period, and sort of had an academic trajectory going as a philosopher and scholar, went to Berlin, taught in a kind of avant-garde school for workers, basically a proletariat kind of university, working class people coming after work. They loved him. He often lectured at their big congresses and so forth. All this while, he himself had an inner path of development which he was following from childhood, which was a spiritual unfolding, you could say, through his own gifts and his own spiritual practices, which he kept very quiet. And then around 1900, he decided he would begin to speak out of those spiritual experiences, which, of course, immediately shut down the whole academic trajectory. His books were returned from the publishers saying, no thanks anymore. It was all very good until now, but somehow you've lost your mind. But in any case, He created for himself what became later known as anthroposophy. If you can say the word, you get a free dessert. But anthroposophy developed from roughly 1900 to 1925. As Tish mentioned, Rudolf Steiner also began in 1900 to speak within the Theosophical Society, to which Maria Montessori also associated herself, but over a variety of philosophical disagreements and so forth, there was a split, and Steiner took his German-speaking enclave with him and founded his own movement. Roughly between 1918, after this First World War, and his death in 1925, a whole variety of people came to Steiner and said, we've been reading and following your spiritual philosophy with some interest, the path of meditation you lay out for us, the scriptures that you comment on, the Gospels, the Old Testament, the Bhagavad Gita, world history, humanity, all kinds of fascinating and extraordinary lectures and books. Don't you have anything to say concerning the practical concerns of our time, education, farming, medicine, and the like? And so the very first, you know, organic impulse, organic farming, so-called biodynamic farming, you can trace back to this set of questions and Steiner's response to them. There are large hospitals that are built up in European countries that practice so-called anthroposophical medicine. But probably the best known of these practical applications is the Waldorf School movement. The Waldorf School movement traces its roots back to Stuttgart in 1919 and Emil Molt, who ran that Waldorf Astoria cigarette factory. Steiner was used to working with working class families and so forth from his Berlin days, and the story goes that he was in a storeroom, something like this probably, but stacked high with tobacco leaves, and all the workers came in and he stood up on the tobacco and talked about the vision of childhood education as he imagined it. Now you have to imagine this is 1919 in post-war Germany. Devastation, segregated by sex classrooms, the poor are basically neglected. It's a Prussian kind of, you know, regimentation. And he was speaking about the spiritual capacities of the child, their possibilities and potential and unfoldment in order to recruit their interest. And so, indeed, the parents became very interested, and Emil Malt put up the money so they could all be basically go to that first school. Nowadays, we have about 170 schools in the U.S., and you see all kinds of numbers for the worldwide, but at least 1,000, probably considerably more, 1,500, something like that, schools worldwide. So aside from parochial schools, you know, this is certainly one of the largest private school movements in the world. Each of the schools is independent. There's no like franchising McDonald's thing. Each one starts according to student interests and so parent interests. And it has, just as Maria Montessori has very much behind it a spiritual philosophy. That is to say, this child is considered to be a developmentally unfolding spiritual being. And this is a very elaborated picture, which I won't go into, in the Waldorf philosophy and training. The Hartsbrook School down below is the school which my wife and I started. Now back in 1981, we opened our doors to 4 children. Now it's nearly 300 students in all grades. That's the composting class my wife teaches, and they all made some honey the other day, so they're all holding up their honey. They have an agricultural arts program that's part of the school's offerings. I wanted to say a little bit about the role of contemplative practice, and there's so many similarities to what Tish was just saying concerning the importance of this practice for the teacher. Importance also, of course, for Rudolf Steiner. In fact, his anthroposophy is sometimes called, in his own language, spiritual science, an attempt to bring a kind of knowledge orientation towards spiritual practice, what I call contemplative inquiry, that there's an inquiry process at the end of this road. While we are all interested in social and emotional learning and ethical conduct and so forth, that is the foundation, in his view, for yet further developments, and those further developments can actually bring the individual to insight. Now, those of us who know something about Buddhism know also that advanced practices also are intended to bring insight concerning the true nature of the individual and the true nature of the world. This is played out in spades in Rudolf Steiner's own meditative path as well. Here's a little quote from one of his lectures. All knowledge of the world, worlds of soul and spirit, slumbers in the profoundest depths of the human soul. it can be brought to light through the path of knowledge, that is to say, meditation. He's become famous for his blackboard drawings, interestingly enough. This is their one of about 1,000 blackboard drawings, and all over Europe especially, you find exhibitions of Steiner's blackboard drawings. Nobody reads the books, but they love the drawings. I'd like to say just a couple of words about the meditative life of the teacher, because just as Tish pointed out, for Montessori, you won't find in a Waldorf classroom zafus or a specific time and place for meditative practice. It's not broken out, and one says, all right, now children, we're going to sit and do one of Steiner's meditations. Nothing of the sort. Although, frankly, having seen and been inspired by what it all you guys are doing, I think maybe we could take a few leaves from your book. It's just so extraordinary what you're all doing. So thank you for that work, you especially up here and the people in Baltimore, our friends back there. It's just fabulous. But imagine this started in 1919. And so you could say the contemplative and meditative suffuses the whole curriculum, suffuses the teaching and the teacher. And in very much the spirit of Parker Palmer, we teach so much of what we teach is who we are. And so if we do teach who we are, then we have to become more. We have to become more fully human. And so that puts a great responsibility on the teacher to undertake a process of self-development. Here's a little mantram or verse, as we call them, Spruch auf Deutsch. Imbue yourself with the power of imagination. Deepen your courage for truth. Refine your feeling of responsibility. This is spoken to the first group of Waldorf teachers at the end of their first lesson, set of lessons they were given by Steiner on Waldorf pedagogy, and was meant really to be taken up as a meditative content in order to help them understand their task. Imbue yourself with the power of imagination. As you'll see in a minute, imagination is absolutely central, especially in the grade school years, to the entire Waldorf curriculum. Deepen your courage for truth. There's this sense of uprightness, of standing for the truth, of the high regard for spiritual truths, as all the way as far as one can see them, this path of knowledge, which is the path of meditation. Refine your feeling for responsibility. That is to say, the moral responsibility we all have towards each other and towards the world must be cultivated, not only just accepted. So this is, I mean, these are internalized and become part and parcel of the teacher's inner life. And when they stand before them, they should really stand before them with the power of imagination, standing for truth with a profound sense of responsibility. That's who they are. And the children take that in through the very presence of the teacher. That's, of course, the ideal situation. Here's the basic framework. There's a wonderful line that he gave. Receive the children in reverence, educate them in love, let them go forth in freedom. And in some ways, this is kind of an archetype, that line, seems to me, of a kind of a curriculum, you could say. The child, a small child, is taken in, let's say, as in preschool or kindergarten, and one receives that child with great reverence for the infinite potential that they have as unfolding spiritual beings. And that we educate them in love, that this world of the feeling life, the world of not just emotions, but the refined sensibilities of feeling that are part of a refined form of love and affection. I mean, so much of what we experienced with the Baltimore story, to me, was, you know, educating these children in love, caring for them, not just because they happen to be sitting in a pew or in a chair in my class, you know, but this is a human being. To educate means to educate them in love. And then to let them go forth in freedom. So you're not indoctrinating them. No anthroposophy is taught, no spiritual direction is given that's contradictory to anything that any faith tradition might bring in. Everyone is welcome, is completely interdenominational or agnostic. Whatever people bring is completely appropriate. I'm going to just mention three phases of childhood as Steiner describes them and try to see if I can indicate the ways in which mindfulness or contemplation was reflected or carried within that cycle of time, in that period of time. Steiner, you may know, has a very much a developmental model, and it's basically a kind of model based on 7-year cycles. First cycle goes from birth to what is actually called a change of teeth, where the model body, which is given by the parents, is completely worked through by the individuality of the child physically. And the last thing, as it were, to get worked through are the teeth, the bony teeth. So this is kind of an image or a metaphor for a deep process. And so you'll see kindergarten and first grade teachers looking to see if the child is shedding those teeth. But up until that time, up until 7, again and again, he says the child best learns through imitation. Not through didactic instruction, but actually just by imitating the teacher, the environment, all the actions, the social organization of the class is just taken in like the child is a great sense organ. And as the child takes in that quality, you could say, of presence in the entire classroom, it shapes, like architectural forces, it actually shapes their nature. So the environment is so important. This is something that you also emphasize through the materials, the quality of the teacher, and so forth. You are the environment. You are the main portal. The didactic, the oral tradition is very alive in Waldorf schools, right? Not so many books, lots and lots of people presenting who they are, what they know, how they live their lives. I'd say the qualities of instruction, especially in those first years, are really based in not just receiving the child in reverence, but cultivating, you might say, the good. What has been called the social-emotional learning. I don't think we would call it that, right, John? We wouldn't call it that. But the idea that the child comes to you needs to be surrounded by a conduct and an inner bearing which is worthy of imitation to the deepest levels possible, which is to say, the good. And so it's so important what the teacher brings in those early years. There's no real instruction in reading, writing, and arithmetic because you won't find computers, you won't find any of that. It's all just delayed. And all of these other kind of human capacities are given complete emphasis. Now, we're in a private school setting. We can do anything we want, more or less, right? So, you know, it's a totally different world. But this is what we want to do. You know, and my son's at Harvard. It didn't hurt him, okay? So it somehow it works. 7 to 14, you could say this is we've gone from the good, we've gone to the beautiful. The child is completely open to the beautiful through imagination. So the artist in the child is just fed again and again. Even when you're doing academic subjects of mathematics and so forth, the first thing you do is you have the child run the triangle. They actually run the forms, and then they draw in great block crayons. They draw the triangles. You know, and only gradually do they do the geometry and the abstract theorems and so forth that are associated with that formal presentation, right? So they live their way through their own body, through gesture, through color, and finally into the abstract. So the arts are constantly part and parcel of the teaching. Now, the final, so I'd say art is embodied contemplation. The final set of years, basically the high school years and my years when I get them in college, that's where you really are working with more of the abstract capacities of analytical reasoning. They shift from colorful drawings largely to black and white, for example. They'll do lots of anatomical sketches and so forth. Sustained attention, practicing idealism, it seems to me, are some of the themes there. The two images, at least the top one I wanted to mention, this is the first grade main lesson book, where a story is told, and out of that story, a king is drawn on the blackboard. The children copy it onto their main lesson books. They don't have any reading books. They just have blank books. That's where they start. They put down the story of the king, and then from that comes the letter K, a little bit like a calligraphed or ideogram, right? That out of the story comes the letter. I wanted to say a little bit something about the embodied contemplative arts and use two examples. Eurythmy, which Steiner also called visible speech or visible music. And students get eurythmy sometimes starting in kindergarten, but certainly first through 12th grades. It's essentially a contemplative movement form, spiritual movement form, which has a very artistic dimension to it from one standpoint, but also pedagogical and also therapeutic forms. I thought we might do a little gesture, a eurythmic gesture, just so you get the feeling of it. So I'm going to ask you to stand up and to distribute yourself just a little bit around so that you have space enough to move your arms left and right. I'm going to stand up here, so maybe it's a little easier for you to see me. So you just need a little space. Now, normally, we'd be in a circle. If you say you had 15 or 20 or 30 children in your class, you'd be in a circle in the eurythmy space. You'd form that circle very carefully. You might do a contraction and an expansion. You might then start a form that you've been working on, which is quite complex. Very often, it's fun to have the parents come in after a few years of the children doing eurythmy, and the parents try to do the eurythmy, and it's just such a hilarious, you know, the children can't believe these clumsy parents can't follow instructions. But this kind of grace in movement, the principles of expansion and contraction of polarity play a great role. So I thought we might do a polarity, which is a eurythmic gesture for, it's actually called the love A polarity or gesture. And one starts by, say, let's put our hands in what is sometimes called the kind of rest position. We feel the earth beneath our feet, so we might even feel how heavy we are. And we feel the good, solid earth beneath our feet. We feel the uprightness of our spine, how there's a kind of shaft of light, and there might be a story that goes with this, that lifts us straight up, and the heavens are above us. We needn't look above, but we can feel ourselves lifted by the heavens above. So we stand our feet upon the good earth, upright, and our head reaching towards the sky. And then we allow our arms to spread. So spread your arms out wide in a gesture of openness. And then turning the hands over just a little bit and then sweeping them in front of you, as it were attending to everything that's around you, as if you were touching the whole world, taking it in with loving care, and then bringing your arms in front of you to cross, centered on yourself. Feel centered in the periphery. Back to the periphery another time, reaching far out in this gesture of love in eurythmy, where you give that loving attention through your hands, far beyond your hands, to the perimeter, and then to the self. One last time in silence. That was wonderful. You guys are great eurythmists. All right, please sit down. Yeah. Form drawing, I won't talk much about, but another form of cultivating attention through the arts, right? The very first lesson in the first grade might be straight and curved. Every letter, every drawing is a combination of straight and curved. And on the right-hand side is a form drawing done by a child, probably in a upper, one of the middle grades or something of that kind, of a knotted form, the kind of thing John, I know, has taught to his classes. Again, where one works contemplatively, you could say, with the arts, where it's a kind of calligraphed form that the child works with. I've chosen to end with two quotes, not by Steiner, but by two other individuals. One Dan actually gave. This is your quote that you didn't give in full, but I thought I'd just give. It's such a fabulous quote, right? The faculty of voluntarily bringing back a wandering attention over and over again is the very root of judgment, character, and will. An education which should improve this faculty would be the education par excellence. But it is easier to define this ideal than it is to give practical directions for bringing it about. Right, the cultivation of attention, and I think this is especially, this quality of attention especially is given there in the elementary grades and especially in the high school grades, where we try through careful observation, careful thinking, what we call Gertian observation, careful phenomenological engagement to cultivate that quality of attention. And then I wanted to end with a few passages, short passages out of Simone Weil's essay, and with a remarkable title, Reflections on the Right Use of School Studies with a View to the Love of God. It's actually a remarkable little essay on attention. She says at the beginning, although people seem to be unaware of it today, the development of the faculty of attention forms the real object and almost the sole interest of studies, which she means by that of school. This is the real point of everything. Most often, attention is confused with a kind of muscular effort, and she talks about this, you know, screwing up your brow and getting really into the subject and grimacing, and she gives quite a lovely description of this false form of muscular attention. But what does she mean by attention? Let me just read you a passage, which I think you'll take pleasure in. Attention consists in suspending our thought, leaving it detached, empty, and ready to be penetrated by the object. It means holding in our minds within reach of this thought, but on a lower level and not in contact with it, the diverse knowledge we have acquired, which we are forced to make use of. Our thought should be in relation to all particular and already formulated thoughts, as a man on a mountain who, as he looks forward, sees also below him, without actually looking at them, a great many forests and plains. Above all, our thought should be empty, waiting, not seeking anything, but ready to receive in its naked truth the object that is to penetrate it. Every school exercise thought of in this way is like a sacrament. I think as we take up this important set of considerations concerning the application of mindfulness, for example, and other forms of meditation in our school settings, I think these two traditions of Maria Montessori's and Rudolf Steiner's, which don't break out the meditative practice per se, but try to find ways in which to suffuse and cultivate an entire environment through a contemplative approach to pedagogy, are a wonderful kind of counterbalance to the understandable need, but yet still dangerous direction of creating mindfulness as a technique. Perhaps some of you feel this. It's so much larger than a technique. It's so much more than a simple technical method, right? It's a way of living, basically, and being in the world. And when you hold it in that kind of regard, while you may, of course, and there were technical manuals on how to meditate, and Steiner wrote them as well, right? As you give that, you also give instruction to say, and yet it is not this, right? It is also something that you carry within you and you bring as presence into the classroom. Those of us who know people like Jon Kabat-Zinn or any other of our great meditation instructors know that that quality is half the teaching, right? And so also we cultivate, by doing these practices ourselves as teachers, that which the child will emulate, that which the child will aspire to, and then improve upon once they get to realize when they're teenagers that we're running around with clay feet and they've got to do better. So thank you, Tish, for inviting me to do a little something in this regard with regards to Waldorf education, and we thought we'd have a conversation with you and maybe even with each other.
Thank you. So at this point, we'd like to open it up, and we can converse, we can have a dialogue with you about this. Obviously, I don't think either of us are saying that, you know, that everybody should start teaching Waldorf or Montessori. I think we're using both of these methodologies as examples of embodied contemplative education. And it might be interesting to find ways to bring this into what we're doing in other settings, in other ways, and that might be something we can talk about.
I agree. You know, what is it? How many? I think it's 45 million children in school now, something like that in the United States. How many children like that around the planet? Did Maria Montessori or Rudolf Steiner imagine that they would be teaching 45 million children? No way. But what I think they probably both felt was that they could offer something by way of inspiration or example that could inspire and be drawn upon. And I think of them as a kind of experiments, laboratories, in which, you might say, some of the spiritual dimensions of education flow into the public settings of our contemporary society. In both cases, Maria Montessori and Steiner, we're talking about private schools. So there have been public Waldorf school experiments. There are experiments working with children who are incarcerated under circumstances that are really dire. How does one take some of the methods and means of Waldorf education? I'm sure Montessori has probably done similar things into those public settings or really difficult teaching environments. Adele?
I have a lot of respect for both traditions, and I know less about Waldorf, even though I know very little about Montessori. But the one question I have is, the sense I have about Montessori is that it's an incredible program if you have a great teacher. Because I think of the teacher as constantly having to, on the fly, problem solve about where the child is so you can adjust it and challenge the child and be present for the child. And if you can do that, it's an unbelievable program. So the question has to do with balancing between the programs none of us would want, which are cookbook programs, you know, sort of the teacher-proof programs that, you know, anybody can do, and the programs that we're never going to have a school full of perfect teachers, you know, and you're not going to have, you know, a lot of teachers who, you know, so how do you get a balance? Because you want to, you know, you want to be able to have it be good enough, even if the teacher isn't perfect, yet, you understand my question.
Yes.
I totally understand your question. And one of the things I forgot to mention when I introduced myself was I taught Montessori teachers for 15 years, and I was also the director of intern teachers during that time, so I spent a lot of time observing teachers and critiquing them and helping them through this process. And it's not easy. And one of the things that was frustrating for me was that it seemed to me that there was a personal developmental process that was required for those teachers that the training didn't always address, you know, that there was a piece missing. And actually, some of you know, I've been developing this training with Richard Brown and Krista Turksma, who's Mark Greenberg's wife, called Awareness and Concentration in Teaching. And I feel like this is sort of what I felt was the missing piece. And it has to do with emotion awareness and self-awareness and practicing self-awareness and practicing, once you've developed that ability to be self-aware and be in tune with your students, then you really bring your full presence into your teaching. And then it really does make a difference. And before that, it was kind of hit or miss. It's like there's some people who are just really good at it, just naturally. And then there's other people that take a lot of work. But, you know, we didn't know exactly what those dimensions were. And we're experimenting with that right now. And that's kind of what my work is directed towards, you know, right now, looking at what that is. And I think it's applicable to all teachers. I think it shows up a lot in these traditions because a lot is required of these teachers. Yeah. I think the same is true.
The same is largely true. You know, you don't start out as a master teacher. And for a master teacher, as I would call it, is everything is internalized and you feel completely free and fluent in your material. I mean, even as a scientist, you know, you're kind of running by the methodology that you were taught in grad school. And then at a certain point, you realize the world's larger and there's a certain freedom and scope that you have as you mature. And the same is certainly true amongst Waldorf teachers. You're given a lot of help and guidance through materials, that is to say, past teachers have written down a lot of kind of materials that help. There's also mentorship that takes place. But, of course, the hope is that you become increasingly fluent in this material and then you teach it out of who you are. You have the added disadvantage, which I don't know if there's really a disadvantage, but the classroom teacher, as you probably many of you know, in Waldorf schools, follows the child through in an ideal circumstance from first through eighth grade. So you're making a new preparation every year for a whole new class, and you only after 8 years plus a sabbatical do you come back and you get to repeat. By then you've completely forgotten everything. But you get to be, you know, two or three times through. By that point, if you haven't really mastered it, become the curriculum, so to speak, something's wrong. But very much what you said, Tish, it's a work in progress for the teachers. John?
Well, Dan spoke last night about relationship and resonance, and we've heard about, you know, how the brain is formed through working through the impressions from the environment, and Maria Montessori's cosmic education, that we're all, you know, part of this greater whole, and Waldorf education, while we might not call it social and emotional intelligence, it's very much about creating community and finding one's part in it. So I don't know, I just wonder if you would care to elaborate on that aspect of a relationship and how this fits in with our topic this weekend, and particularly from those two backgrounds.
I could start, yeah. There's a line from Goethe, who's taken as one of the kind of inspiring figures in the background of Waldorf education, which I often think of in this regard, where he says, "Every new object well contemplated opens a new organ in us." Every object well contemplated opens an organ in us. This idea that by contemplating well, by actually living into an environment, into a relationship, it might be a relationship with, you know, a botanical specimen, it might be a relationship with a classmate, it might be a relationship that's established through a play, but by living into it fully, not only do you gain some sense information, but you're actually sculpting human capacities. The way in which I think Dan was talking about through the actual neurophysiology, it works all the way down into the physical organization. Steiner was probably thinking of a spiritual kind of organ when he was referring to such things. But I think they have their traces all the way down into the body, all the way down into the physical organization. This happens, and I think this is one of the things that you're trying to point out, this happens not only in a sort of against dead academic material, you know, that you might be studying geometry or literature or something of that sort. But as you know far better than I, so much of the life of the Waldorf School is just that. It happens between students and their teacher, who accompanies them, and their whole variety of other teachers who are part of it, and sometimes between classes that they take up projects, plays, work in the larger community. And as they live their way into those relationships, the bonds and the impressions are extremely deep, and I'm sure also affect them all the way down. I don't know about the social-emotional intelligence kinds of issues that would naturally arise in those kind of contexts, but it's certainly as you well know, a strong part of the Waldorf curriculum. Tish, I don't know if you want to add something from the Montessori standpoint.
I think it's really similar. I think when you start with the understanding that of this cosmic connection among all of us, that we are all interrelated, and that the teacher brings to this environment this deep, deep respect for the child, they're modeling how to be with one another. They're modeling a human connection that's very, very deep. And when the adult brings that to an environment, the children model it, especially if it starts with young children early on. If their first experience in school is with a teacher with this deep respect, they model that. So you see the environment becomes one that promotes a deep respect for one another. And when there is conflict or when there is a problem, the teacher's role is a facilitator. It's not necessarily going to try to control the situation, but allows a space for the two individuals to work out their differences in a respectful way. So I think that the teacher's modeling is really the beginning of this process.
Right, very much so. Like that.
I'm winking at Richard over there because this is a carryover from our dinner conversation. I will acknowledge that this is, that mindfulness is a spiritual practice. But in the alphabet, S and R are very closely related. And in out in the world, in a public school, disentangling spirituality and religion gets a little tricky. And I just want to pull some threads from conversations from the weekend so far, because another conversation that I had with Mark is, you know, is mindfulness just paying attention, or are the, is it a values-based practice? And I think as we move forward, and I've said this to a couple people, but you know, that wave that you showed this morning is gorgeous, but waves are powerful and they're sometimes dangerous. And I think as we move forward, particularly for those of us who are devoted to bringing this to public schools, how we use language is absolutely crucial. And it's surprising what will, you know, turn off a parent, who will turn off the school board, who will turn off the school district. And so I think we just need to be really, really careful.
Thank you for bringing that up, because I think it's really, really important. And obviously what we are describing are independent schools that, you know, don't necessarily, although there are charter schools, there are public schools, yeah. And they do have to eliminate that part of the curriculum. Not necessarily, I think the respect, the deep respect for the child can be experienced irregardless of anything you call spiritual, I believe. I don't know, what do you think about that?
Yeah. You know, it's not to say, you know, Waldorf schools have been barraged by a very tiny number of people, but who make life extremely difficult. There have been lawsuits, there have been child custody battles over all kinds of things of that sort. And, you know, you also, though, have to ask at some point, what do you stand for? You know, you can be intimidated to the point where you capitulate prematurely, you know, and the notion that anything is somehow value-free, you know, that we're going to have a curriculum which is value-free. Well, even that is a value. That's a kind of, you know, that's a notion which can't actually be, I think, supported. So you have values, and I think they should be well considered, and an inclusive set of values and so forth, so that parents are fully engaged and feel ownership in that regard. The public Waldorf schools have been litigated against consistently, and the people who have been defending them all the way up until very high levels of the court have been the school districts at great expense to themselves, because they so value what it is that the public Waldorf schools can offer their children. This is in Sacramento. Over probably a decade now, right? So I think that's right. You know, Waldorf schools in their pure form are private schools, and so people can choose to come or not. There's no, as I said, specific instruction in any kind of spiritual anthroposophical matters, so the parents are completely respected. By the same token, they all know that every one of those teachers is carrying those children at night in their meditations, okay? And that is the spiritual background. And they say, yes, I'd like to have that way of carrying my child. Now, that's their freedom to do that. Now, in European countries, they're mostly all supported by the state. There are small compromises that are made as a consequence. In the United States, the charter schools get supported by the state. John is just starting a charter school, which is not officially a Waldorf school, but out of your many years of teaching in Waldorf education, there's going to be huge amounts of Waldorf stuff there. So I think we're in a time where these principles, as you say, it's a dangerous, dicey, complicated time. But in some ways, I wouldn't have it any other way.
Yeah, and I'm not saying not to stand for things. So there's the what of what we stand for, and there's the how of how we stand.
Yes, yes.
And both.
Finding public language for this. I mean, in my work with higher education, you know, it's constantly a question. Now, it's easier for me because the kids come and they can take my course or not. They can argue with me. They can shut me down. I mean, they can do all kinds of things. You can't do that in elementary school if you're a student. So those issues are a little less complicated. Sometimes I think we overdraw the possible consequences. Yes, there are going to be always people out there who think this anything, dancing, is demonic, right? You know, they'll say, you know, look at them. They're playing rock and roll music. It's the demons. Well, you know, you say, I'm sorry, we're going to do this. And at the same time, I completely honor what you're talking about. I mean, Jon Kabat-Zinn is very strategic in this regard, right? He never uses the S word. You know, he's very conscious. He and I talk, and he said, yeah, it's just, it was a choice. Don't say the S word. You know? Richard?
This is a different topic. And it's probably a developmental issue. Our daughter went through Waldorf through sixth grade. And in Waldorf education, in the elementary years, the teacher is the window to the world, is a very important idea. And that teacher at the front of the classroom, as the model, as you've talked about, is the key element of the, of, you know, just things revolve around what that teacher says and what that teacher puts up on the board in writing and in pictures. And there was very, very little work between students, cooperative kind of learning, because the focus was really between the teacher and each individual student. Now, I've been working with teachers in a Montessori school, and they've been describing something that changes at about grade 3 or 4, where kids are starting to work in groups. And so I'm wondering about the difference in kind of the conception, in terms of the idea of the development of the child, and if you could kind of just speak to that difference.
You know, Montessori and Rudolf Steiner really had very different ideas about development in certain areas that are kind of
puzzling somehow.
Puzzling, they really are, because they're, you know, and I don't really want to accentuate the differences between them because they are there. And
but there are distinctions, yeah.
Very, very definite. I mean, in Montessori, and what I can do is speak to Montessori, and you can speak to Waldorf. But in Montessori, the idea is that really young children are not really well regulated, or they don't have a sense of understanding of another person's thinking process to do much collaborative work. They tend to parallel play. So really young preschool kids will do a lot of individual work. They might sit next to their friend, but they'll be doing different things. Around 5 or 6, they start to have these interactions and start collaborating, but they fight a lot. But that's part of the process of learning how to cooperate and work together, and usually it's 1 or 2 together. And then, you know, around 8, 9 years old, they really start doing projects together. You know, they actually do organized learning projects, in a group. One thing I have to say is when I started teaching elementary school, after teaching preschool for a while, the thing I noticed was that when you start to do that, there's a lot of arguing, because they're learning how to work together. And that it really surprised me when I started doing that, how much they argued and how much work it took. But this is social-emotional learning. You know, when you're trying to do something with a group of people, how do you manage who gets to decide about what? You know, how do you do that? So I think that's sort of the sequence in Montessori. Then there's also this movement later on in the older grades to move out into the community and start to go out and see what other people are doing out in the world, in the work world, and get to try out things out that way. So there's this movement from working individually to pairs to cooperative learning. That's
yeah, I'll keep it brief because there are a couple of people who want to say something. But I think in general, there's a sense of increased individuation over time in the Waldorf school. That is to say, sometimes the image is given of a kind of mother hen with the brood all around her, right? In the very early period, and or the father hen, however that works, transgender, who knows. But and then as the children become older, there's a certain sense of gradual individuation, you know, that they become increasingly individuated, and they begin to take a little bit more opposition to the teacher, begin to work, as it were, testing the teacher, testing out each other, you know, what's fair, who's right, who's wrong, those sorts of things. And now pedagogically, there's lots of theater that's done. There's lots of festivals that are performed. There's lots of choral and orchestral music that's done. So there are lots of occasions to bring the children together, and so they can work in those sorts of ways. But it's a good question, Richard. You're sitting next to John or close to John, and he could probably give you more detail as to how the actual developmental sequences go and how Waldorf teachers try to handle those changes. I do think, again, I think that each one of these traditions, you know, if you're 90 years old, you have a certain amount of baggage. That is to say, there's so much history, so much tradition, and some of the things that were appropriate 90 or 70 or 50 or even 20 years ago may no longer be quite adequate. So we need to be able to learn from each other, need to take up new research, need to take up the new challenges and so forth. And I can't speak for your tradition, but I will speak for the Waldorf tradition. I think that is a challenge for us. We have a lot of history. And that history has a lot of commitments. That is to say, it's slightly ideological. That is, you know, we care a lot about truth, but the truth has to also live in a time. It has to also unfold over time. So we need to increasingly find ways to be open to the new.
I want to just add on to that I believe in, you can tell me if I'm wrong, but both Montessori and Waldorf sort of are seeped in a culture, too. They originated in a culture in Germany and Italy. And you know, they don't necessarily translate in this time and place all that well.
That's very true. Dan?
Yeah, thank you for the presentations. This is just a brief comment and a question on the art and science of what you're presenting. The first comment is about the issues about our needing to be careful about spirituality and religion, and what can we do in this group here at Garrison on the weekend to think about how to make cultural shifts. And it seems that we're at a point now in the science of mindfulness to actually make statements that are very independent of religion, even though mindfulness is practiced in various religions around the globe, but where we can make a statement such as the teaching of viewing the mind through reflection leads to resilience, and that we know that this kind of teaching is actually a way of building the prefrontal cortex. So if we're presenting to a Department of Education, if we're presenting to policymakers, we're at a place now where we can make statements backed up by huge amounts of science where we say that modern education, maybe not Waldorf and Montessori, but modern education is failing to develop the prefrontal cortices of the youth of the next generation, and this is really a crime. And so if we wanted to stick purely to science to avoid the issues that were being raised that I think are very, very important to avoid, we say, okay, well, how do we actually develop prefrontal education? We can learn from Montessori and learn from Waldorf, which I don't know if there's science behind it, but certainly a lot of experience, right, where it's probably the deep presence of the teachers there, where they embody the experience and they embed the student's own internal subjective experience inside of them, which is basically the basis of secure attachment. And so we're saying that this resonance that happens mm-hmm. in a classroom has profound positive impacts on a child, just like it has in a family. So that's very much about prefrontal development, this whole idea that resonance leads right. to exactly what happens with reflection, which is this internal form of resonance. So it seems like we're at a place, and this is really the question part of this, where we can make sure we don't mix up mindfulness with religious connections, and even the word spirituality, which we were having our discussion at lunch, or the discussion time before lunch, that even spirituality can be interpreted as so many people do in the connotation of a form of interconnectedness. And that if we just look at the research, the scientific research on wisdom, and you find that people in communities who are identified as the wise members of the community are said to live a life where they believe deeply in the interconnectedness of all of us, and that they devote themselves to something much larger than their bodily self. So you can say, even from a research point of view, we want to teach our students wisdom, and we want to develop their prefrontal cortices, and the way we want to do this is by actually focusing on the mind itself as the object to be developed, and we can do this through whatever we're going to call it, mindfulness or reflection, whatever word is going to work. And so it seems to me, that's what Montessori and Waldorf embody, and that's my question for you, if that would fit with both your experiences in those systems.
I think that's great, and one of the things I love about the way you articulate this is this idea of interconnectedness, because it's not just being attentive, you know, it's attentive in a relationship, and it's that attention to the relationship and through the relationship that we feel that interconnectedness and feel the connection with one another. And I think when you do feel connected with one another, like Montessori said, then you have this deep respect because you know that other is self. They're not. They're totally connected.
Yeah, exactly.
So when you hurt other, you hurt self.
Yes.
I agree.
Well, I think, you know, skillful means. In America today, science counts. I mean, I'm a physicist. Science counts. And if you have evidence-based medicine, evidence-based education, evidence-based agriculture, evidence-based everything, and you can bring evidence, even if it only captures, frankly, 5 or 10% of what's really happening, people say, oh, and they salute the flag of science, right? And then you get funded. And you didn't press any red buttons and step on any booby traps, and you got an opportunity to go forward. In my heart of hearts, is that what I think it's only, and I think for you also, is it only the prefrontal cortex I'm interested in?
No.
Of course not.
No, of course.
Right? But is this a door which people can all say, listen, at least this is totally clear and legit? You know, are we going to argue with this? No. We got people at UCLA, we got people all over the planet who are verifying this stuff. Okay, this kind of work is beneficial. Now, it has all kinds of other benefits, which, in fact, they also believe in, right? But because they're on the school boards, they have to pretend in some way, shape, or form not to be caring about that part. It's all evidence-based. I mean, to me, it's a little bit of a Trojan horse. You know, you bring in a lot more, which is, I think, of deeper value than is captured by any kind of biomedical model. That's my conviction. Now, it's not to say that the biomedical model doesn't do good work for you and isn't true and valuable. But, of course, you know, that's not the reason the Buddha came and we got him back here. He didn't come for the prefrontal cortex. He came for the whole person.
Of course.
Yeah, which I'm not saying anything you don't agree with, and I know that.
No, I agree with everything you're saying.
But it's just skillful means.
When you approach people with funding, like policymakers, or I was in New Zealand recently and had to speak in front of the parliament, you know, the issue was, were they going to put funding up, let's say, to help children who were being abused? And so I took out a model of the brain, not because the brain is the whole thing about abuse, but I said, look, here's what abuse and neglect does to the children of your country. And I pointed out the areas in the brain. They happen to be the integrative fibers of the corpus callosum, the prefrontal areas, and the whole brain is smaller. And I said, it was a very short little talk I gave. I just said, if you don't try to prevent this, you're going to have people with brain damage. And I sat down, and they got a lot of funding. And I could have said, oh, it's really not a good thing. It hurts when you're abused. It really feels bad. And it's just really a sense that really is not right. And they would have said, get this guy out of here. But when you do science in terms of policy formation, no, seriously, in terms of policy, it's not making it up. We actually know these scientific realities now. We couldn't have said this 10 years ago.
Yeah.
We can say them now. And so since this is what gets policymakers really to pay attention, I just think we all should know that. So as in our individual districts, in public fields or in private schools, we actually now are ready to go forward with this kind of effective information.
And thank you for doing the research. You know, frankly, I think one good quantitative paper like that, you know, there are thousands of papers on meditation, thousands, you know, the bibliographies that are out there. They're completely ignored. Richie Davidson does one experiment with 8 monks, you know, in his fMRI machines for a few tens of thousands of dollars of extra money. It's on the cover of Time magazine. It's changing policy everywhere, right? Same thing with your kind of work, Dan. So, you know, thank you. I mean, in some ways, it's sad that we need that level of detail and hard evidence, that it's not more obvious to us just directly, but thank you.
That
Just to say thanks very much for both your presentations, found it very useful. And I just want to pick up on something as well that you both said, and the lived experience, that contemplation is a lived experience, and the embodiment through both these traditions, the embodiment in the whole class. And I know we train teachers back home in Ireland, and we also work with schools. And a huge thing with the teachers in Ireland is very much, you know, give us manuals, give us class plans, give us, and they ask us what is the magic spell that we have over the children. And what we're always saying is, we lead, if we want to bring contemplation into the classroom, we need to live that contemplative life. And even, never mind about language, like take language out of it, your presence, you know, and how you are with the children. And like what you're saying about the imitating, and they, and if you're calmer, they will be calmer. And I think that was a very important point that you both took in your presentation. You know, leave language, leave spirituality, all at the door, because there's a huge fear, you know, of that in this room that I'm feeling. And even just that, the basic lived experience of contemplation and meditation, or not meditation, mindfulness, whatever word you want to put it in, and whatever tradition, the children will pick up on that, and just for them, I think it's very key, I know we do it with our teachers, that we explain to them as well that they need to have their own journey, their own practice, whatever that may be, whatever tradition that may be, and that's, it's, they won't find that in the manuals or the CDs or anything. So I just want to thank you for talking about that and the embodiment.
Thank you.
I want to address something that has clearly been present here at this meeting, but hasn't been made as explicit as the reflection and contemplation. It doesn't appear in the name of the initiative of the Garrison Institute, doesn't appear in the name of this meeting, it doesn't appear in the name of in Mark, but it was Dan's talk really made me think about it. Because we're fundamentally social creatures, and relationship is sculpting the brain. And when we talk about mindfulness, we're talking about training the brain. We're talking about training the mind to be disciplined, to be able to focus, etc. But we're not talking about love and compassion. And really, what they grow out of is experiencing love and compassion. And I mean, that's been so true in everything, that Janice loves her students. It was so clear that she loves her students. The guys from Baltimore, it was so clear that they love the kids they're working with. And they make time for the kids they're working with because they care about them. Your teachers have this relationship where they follow, they stay with the students for 8 years. They include them in their meditative practice in the evening. Your teachers are modeling the respect for the students. I mean, it's part and parcel of what we're talking about here, but it's not made explicit, and it's so critical. Because if you want to have people give love and compassion, they need to feel it. They need to have it modeled. And I just think it needs to be more explicit in what we're talking about.
Bravo. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Adele. Thank you.
So I'm Jackie Schoenert from Oakland, California. And I wanted to respond to Adele a couple of things. What you said about teachers needing to be excellent teachers, and I think that's true of any classroom or any approach. That so there are a lot of efforts going on to teach teachers to be good facilitators. And I wanted to mention a couple of them and invite people to look into this, because I think we don't have to reinvent the wheel. And the one way we're thinking of mindfulness and bringing it into the public schools in Oakland, where I work, I'm the inside public school person, is to link it to what's already there. And we have some excellent things already happening. And these are national programs. One is Second Step, which is a social-emotional curriculum based on solid research. And I'm sort of surprised. I'm so steeped in it, I thought everybody knew it. It starts with empathy. And it starts with empathy because it's based on research that shows that children with, or humans with problems with aggressions are lacking empathy and certain skills, impulse control, and so on. These things are all integrated. There's a program called Tribes that is an approach. It's not a curriculum. It's based on the resiliency research, and it's very big on teaching reflection. And Tribes for years has had, as part of its process, at the end of the day, appreciation circles. There's not a hint of spirituality or mention of any of this, but it's a very deep part of the practice. So there's a lot out there to find to link to that's very solid. The Responsive Classroom, which started right here in Greenfield, Mass., is another wonderful program that one of their main books is Teaching Children to Care. And another one is Yardsticks, which I brought one copy, but Yardsticks I recommend because it talks about developmental issues. Sorry for this is my last point. There's a developmental studies center that's based, that has a caring school community program that has many facets, but class meetings are part of it. And it's based on the research around school attachment that the boys that were here today perfectly modeled that. If students attach to us, then they adopt the values, or whatever they attach to, they adopt the values. So I would just want to appreciate, and there's someone here from Second Step, there's a researcher, I just want to mention Brigitte Norman, who's, I've learned so much from all that research, and from every, Linda Lantieri, oh, Educators from Social Responsibility. I think that probably everyone here in some way is connected to things that I've been learning from, so thank you.
Thank you. Hi. This is kind of a historical question. It really kind of struck me when I was looking at the dates that were going on with Steiner, that number one, how did the Waldorf schools survive Nazi Germany? And more importantly, how did Nazi Germany survive the Steiner schools? And how can, I mean, maybe it's kind of a call to arms to, I mean, we've had this kind of education, I don't know, technology for so long, and why is it taking so long to turn things around? Maybe it's just my, you know, impatience, but.
Yeah, anyways, yeah.
Thanks. By the way, and thank you so much for this whole conference. It's unbelievable.
Thank you, Tish. Yeah. With regards to Steiner and Nazi Germany, and remember, 1924, I think it was that the year of the march in Munich that Hitler made on the so-called, down the, so to speak, the main street of Munich. It was a notice, I remember, being put up at the world headquarters of this movement that Steiner was starting, and he simply looked at that and remarked, if this man comes to power, I'll never be able to visit Germany again. And the schools were closed. They were shut down, and some of the teachers were put in concentration camps and the like. But immediately after the war, they put on a big effort to try and reopen, and then ultimately reopened all of the schools and many other schools in addition. So you had a lot of suffering on many people's parts, especially those who had, you might say, the heart of the future truly in mind, as opposed to this extraordinary demonic shadow that took over Europe just in that time.
Well, it's interesting, too, speaking of fascism during that time, but Marie Montessori actually was, for a very short time, sort of the minister of education under Mussolini. And what happened was he started becoming very dictatorial about what people were supposed to do in schools. It included saluting. And when that happened, she said, no way. And she pulled. She was actually basically thrown out of the government because she refused to go by his edicts. And that's how she ended up in India, was sort of to get away from the fascism of Europe at that time.
But I think you're asking also a big question, and I just want to honor it. You know, why has it taken us so long? You know, sometimes I feel like there was a magical period around 1900 to 1920 or so, we'll say up until the time of the First World War, where, well, in the physics community, I mean, all the new physics is happening. Think of the Blue Rider School and expressionism, abstract expressionism. Think of the new music that's being created. Think of the new impulses in education. It's just amazing what's going on. Just amazing. You feel like there's this huge impulse for cultural renewal that's flooding into the Western world. And, you know, Kandinsky's going to Steiner's lectures. You know, you've got people like Miriam Montessori working with Freud. I mean, it's just amazing. And then First World War breaks out by some kind of act of idiocy, right? An assassination in Sarajevo that then unwinds and everybody thinks it's going to be over by the weekend, and then it ends up being the biggest bloodbath ever. you know, and the war to end all wars. And the seeds of that war are no sooner concluded, and Steiner talks about this, actually. He's frantically trying to get the 14 points of Wilson's off the table because he sees this is going to precipitate another conflict. It's such a completely ridiculous way of concluding the war, right? And sure enough, the seeds are laid, and it's only a matter of years, really, until already, you know, in Germany, the machinery starts again. So you really have, between 1914 and 1945, the great tragedy of European history, when so much is about to take off and ignite, and I think would have affected world culture in general in a most extraordinary way. And it has to wait to the post-war period, and I think to the post-war period, including the baby boomers. That is to say, all those children born right after that war, they're born into a time of possibility for the first time. The 60s revolution, I think, is a kind of resurgence of what was trying to happen in 1910, 1920, and was cut off and then completely strangled through Nazi Germany. And I think we're still, places like Garrison, I actually see as the descendants of that impulse, now shifted to new quarters like the US and not just Europe, but it's carrying that creative energy, which I personally think of as a spiritual lineage, but that creative energy, and it has great work to do. Now we're in the crisis again. I mean, you've got financial markets that are kind of going teetery. You've got the environment that's right there. Did we lose too much time? You know, but we just keep pressing it with the urgency that we all know exists. So thank you for that larger, you know, why did it take us so long? It was, I think, a historic screw-up of the huge proportions.
We'll take two more questions, and then I think it's time to move on. I think, which one of you were first?
I forget.
Thank you. Hello, thank you. I'm really grateful to be here. I unfortunately had to miss most of today, but I do feel this profound sense of movement and change and energy. So my work is in public schools and in charter schools, and I actually have a title of social-emotional learning. So lucky enough to be able to be really explicitly and intentionally in that work. And that being said, it seems that the spirituality piece of social-emotional learning could sort of evolve without an explicit teaching, but just sort of seems to be this amazing byproduct that, like all good teaching, evolves from the learning of the learner and doesn't need to be presented as a means, but as a beautiful evolution or byproduct. And I think the other piece that I've been learning about in positive psychology, when they talk about what is a full, happy, engaged life, the three parts are pleasure, which is the least of the three, engagement or meaning and interest, and the third being meaningful, so something beyond oneself. So that connection and that interconnection really is what that field is showing really makes us truly happy. So my question, being in the public school realm dealing with the very deep, profound realities that we face as educators under this administration, is around assessment. And I wonder what the Montessori and Waldorf schools can say about assessment and how we can go about showing that this work is meaningful and is making an impact and is helping our children to evolve their empathy. We do use Second Step, and it's fabulous. So, but we are constantly looking in our work at trying to measure and assess and show, so we can continue to open our schools and serve the young people that we serve in Philadelphia. So, anything you could speak that we could learn about assessment? Thank you.
Oh, I wish I had an answer for you.
Yeah.
I think we're actually in a very dark period in education when the assessment, such as it is really the focal point. And I hope that soon we will move beyond this because, and to speak from a Montessori perspective, the Montessori curriculum is very individualized so that each child is respected as an unfolding human spirit in their own individual way. So each child will demonstrate capabilities and interests at different points in time that are perfectly okay where they happen to be. And there's a deep respect for the individual developmental process, which cannot be uniform because everybody's different. So that one child may read really well at age 7, and another child might not read till they're 9. And when we're all 40, does it really matter? I'm not giving you an answer, obviously, that is going to be useful. I think I know there's a movement to recognize that that these kinds of rigid performance standards that are very, I don't know how to describe this, they don't recognize the whole person. They're very limiting and restricting. What happens is teachers end up having to teach to that test. I have to describe something I observed the other day it's a perfect example of this. I was in a school observing a class, and the teacher told me that this third grade boy had failed a question on a standardized test. It was a multiplication question. It required long multiplication. And he didn't know long multiplication. He didn't understand it. But rather than trying to break down long multiplication, or even going back to basic multiplication and start showing through manipulatives or whatever it took to understand what multiplication is, she was torturing this child into doing this problem using addition because she wanted him to be able to pass the test question. Not because she cared about whether he understood multiplication or not, but because she wanted him to pass this test question. And this question was something, the way to do it in addition was something like 9 times 12. Or no, it was like, anyway, she had him adding it in a way that made it really difficult. And they were both totally confused. And she was really mad at him. And he was completely befuddled. And as she would get mad at him, he would get more paralyzed in fear. And there was no learning happening. What this child was learning was, I don't know and I don't understand and this teacher's mean. You know, and how can you learn multiplication like that? And the focus was he's got to pass this test question. So I'm sorry I don't have a better answer for you. Do you have anything to say about that?
You know, unfortunately also, Waldorf schools, there's a lot of written assessment that's done. You know, there are school reports that are written by every teacher who has the child, which includes many subject teachers, right, because they're taking two foreign languages, music, and so forth from the beginning. So they're all giving comments concerning the learning that's going on, the characteristics of the child, the challenges, the successes, and so forth. So it's a document. It's a big deal. It takes a lot of time to produce. It's not just A, B, C. And so there is a lot of assessment that goes on, but it's qualitative assessment.
Yeah, same with Montessori.
Yeah, and so, you know, this is... And since, again, they're private schools, you know, and the teachers and the parents are having regular meetings, this all... If it runs well, it works in a very supportive way. You know, I can remember my son taking the PSAT test. He had never taken a test, right? So he was sure he was going to fail, you know. But so they taught him about tests and bubbles and things like that in eighth grade to prepare them for the PSAT test, you know. He did great. I mean, in fact, he got double 800s. So it's just, you know, he just didn't have a clue about standardized testing. Doesn't hurt. It's like you say, you know, what are the things that we do? Does it really matter whether you learn at age 7 or age 9 to read? Doesn't really matter. What matters is so much more that individualized developmental process. But I'm afraid I don't. You know, the one thing I would say is if you don't like the way it's being assessed, change the assessment that's required. You know, I do believe in research. In other words, if you say that something good is happening, you should be able to show in a sensible and reasonable way that you have a way of determining that. If you can't fail, then you can't properly succeed. So rather than only complain about the narrowness of the measures and the kind of myopia of those instruments, you know, take the bull by the horns and create new ones. There ought to be qualitative research methods, anthropological methods, whatever it is that's required that will do at least a competent job. It may take some years to norm them and standardize them and so forth. But we ought to be able to develop our own measures. I think we're coming towards an end. There's another question or comment that's in the wings, but please.
Yes, I may be coming here for a slightly different reason or motivation than some of you. My primary interest, in addition to a lifelong practice of contemplation and meditation, is the relationship of physical space and learning and behavior. And I'm an urban designer, and I work with a team of of architects in New Jersey, and we are hired by the state of New Jersey to be their advisors in the construction of some 200 to 300 new schools that are required by the courts in low-income communities throughout New Jersey, the Trentons and the Newarks and the Pattersons and so forth. And I've been able to free up some of my time to begin to explore the question is, what can we learn and how can we apply the pedagogical approaches and lessons of contemplative education, of Montessori, of Waldorf, of other alternatives to the design of our new school buildings? And that's really what my question is to you, and where are those resources? Because I'm just now beginning to explore whether there's a there.
Well, I mean,
obviously, if we could recreate a space like this in every school or the equivalent, that would go a long way to do that.
I'm not sure about Waldorf, but Montessori, if you Google Montessori architecture, there is a whole school of Montessori architecture that you can find. And there's a lot you can read if you just Google that. You'll see there are people thinking about a Montessori environment and how to create it with architecture.
And have you found that to be true in the Montessori spaces that you've worked in?
Yeah, unfortunately, I haven't had an opportunity to really design my own space. I wish I had. So a lot of the environments I've worked in haven't been ideal. And, you know, I've noticed, you know, shortcomings of different environments that I've had. So I do feel that the physical environment is really, really, really important. It creates a space in a lot of different ways. And, you know, the sound, the size of the space, the furnishings, it's all, you know, like I said, in Montessori, we understand that the child is absorbing their environment. So, you know, obviously the space that you're in is really important.
Same thing in Waldorf. You'd find quite a lot of literature on this, especially in European schools where they've spent a lot of time, energy, and money in developing these sorts of ideas. There's Eric Asmussen, an award-winning architect, actually Danish, but living and spending most of his time in Sweden, in Järna, a little town outside Stockholm. Is quite well known for his school designs and so forth. And just to give you a sense, very often you'll find each classroom has a different shape. You know, what's the mood you want for the first grade? Relative to the teacher embedded in the classroom with the children sort of all again huddling around. What's the mood you imagine later on as the child grows older? How does that reflected and supported by the architecture? What about the high school classrooms? Again, entirely different aesthetic and could say inner quality that needs to be supported. The use of color is very important. Steiner himself already gave indications as to the color sequences through the different years. The application of the color is very often done using what's called the Zur technique, which is a kind of wall treatment where there's, as opposed to a flat uniform color surface, it's a kind of dynamic set of washes that are put on, which give a much more living texture to the wall surface itself in order to enliven. The idea is to, through the shape, which is more sculptural, and through the application of color, to create a kind of living space that the child is put inside of. Steiner called this a kind of organic architecture and tried some things out in his own life, and people have embellished and developed those principles and tried to apply them in hospital settings as well as school settings and so forth, that this is actually, architecture is educative. So, you know, by all means, it's terrifically important. It's part of that environment, which is done consciously, contemplatively, as opposed to just boxes that you inhabit somehow for those periods of time.
Did you apply any of those principles in your own school that you started?
We did, yes, right. Both schools were designed by Charles Rose. I don't know, he's got a big write-up in the New York Times at one point. And the school's rooms, the new school, we have two major buildings, and one of them actually does have sculptural spaces. That's to say they've been organized according to these principles. And I think, you know, within the limits of finances that we had, we did pretty well. You always wish you had more resources so you could do better. But color, design, lighting, acoustics, all those things are so key. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
It's a really important task that you're about.
I think, is it a quick question?
It's a 30-second matter.
Okay.
Real quick. Just because of your math story, in my school we're doing mindfulness, and this week a first grade teacher came up to me really excited because that the kids had gotten a refresher from a program that was this fall, and the teacher reminded the children about an exercise, so she went, watch me. And first she went, and then she went, and then an hour later they were doing a base 10 math lesson. And they had a pretty arduous assignment. And one of these little first grade girls was really nervous and getting very upset. She puts her pencil down. She goes, she picks her pencil up, finishes the assignment, and turns it in. That's why we should do that. Every school board should allow us to.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you. Before I pass the microphone on to David, I just want to make a little announcement, because I'm not sure if Lyndon mentioned this to you at dinner the first night, but this is tick season around here, and you should be wary of that or mindful of ticks. So if you're taking walks out here, just you need to check yourselves. And if you, the bathroom, that there's a little alcove outside the woman's bathroom over there, and there's tick, there's repellents and things. So just watch yourself.